you have to be self-motivated. Like, you have to be a problem solver. And you have to just be a little tenacious. Like, I mean, stuff gets rough sometimes and you have to go home and be like, I'm gonna do it one way or the other. I'm gonna do it. And sometimes people just don't have those qualities. And I don't think you can make someone be that person.
Hi, everyone. This is Joshua Hoffman and Alex Garashenko, and welcome to another episode of the Masters in Marketing Agency podcast, where we deconstruct the why and how agency owners found their success, and in season three, discuss how to build a community. Today, I have Amelia Varon, the president of Meteora, a digital marketing agency that specializes in lead generation, website creation, and online advertising. Welcome, Amelia.
Hi, guys.
Hey.
So, as you know, this is the first time that we're interviewing two people from the same agency. Our first episode, of course, was with your CEO, Andrew Abersold. Oh, did I mess up his last name?
Abersold.
That was close enough. I had a great time with on that interview.
That was a great episode.
I love that. So if anyone's listening to this, you should definitely check that as well. But before we talk about your role as president and kind of how you got there, I'd actually like to start by learning a little bit more about your beginnings with the agency. So I'll start with a very, hopefully, easy question, which is, how did you meet Andrew?
Yeah, so my husband, Adam, has known Andrew's wife for a long time. So when we got together a million years ago at this point, I was kind of casually introduced to them and then kind of got to talking about what we did. And then it kind of segued into working here. So.
Oh, we're definitely going to break that down a little bit more. So is it like, did you want to work there in the beginning? Like, what did that relationship, since if you guys knew each other before, like, how did you end up working for the company?
Yeah, I mean, I was in print. I kind of was like, I don't know if there's much future here. And so I had kind of thought about web development because it's, you know, an easy move a little bit because I was doing kind of graphic design type stuff. So we were out at dinner one day and I was like, do you have any jobs? You know? And he was like, well, I mean, what are your skills essentially? And I told him and he was like, well, I don't need any of that. But here's what I would need. So do that. Come talk to me. I did that and then came back.
What was it specifically?
I mean, I didn't have any development skills. I bought a class. Kind of taught myself after work at my job before this, got the certificates, all that stuff, and then came back probably, I don't know, 5 months, 6 months later and was like, hey, I took some classes. I know that stuff now. Can we talk now? And he was like, oh, I didn't know that you would actually do that. Like, so yeah. Then we talked.
Is that
he's probably taken back. Like that's unusual for someone to actually, you know, take a little bit from a conversation, then go and actually do it and say, okay, yeah, what's next?
That's why I want to keep breaking that down before we get into like the rest of the stuff. Cause I think that's so amazing. I honestly think that's that's the first time we've heard something like that on these interviews where of that type of approach. Was there something that like made you think that you could just do it? Or did you say, it was such motivation that you didn't want to be what you were doing prior that you'll do anything? Like, what gave you the confidence to even jump to square one, assuming that the end of the path was going to be there?
I mean, I liked what I was doing prior to here. I think it was more just, you know, let me buy the class, see if I even like it, you know, see if I can do it, if it makes sense. So it was more just for me, like, I guess not even for getting the job, like, let me see if I can even like do this kind of work. And then, you know, I got into the classes and I was like, okay, like, I think I can do this. So I just kept going. But, you know, at my job before this, I was working afternoon shifts. So I'd get home at like 11:30 at night, do my classes. I had to buy a computer like to take the classes because I just never had really messed with it after college, didn't need one. So yeah. And then came back, hey, I did it. Let's talk.
But what was next? Yeah.
Well, real quick before going to next, like development work is just different. Like it's not anything, I mean, I shouldn't say anything, but it's not that related to print. It's not that related to like what 99% of us are doing in our lives. Was there, like, did you know that going in? Was there some skill that you already knew that you had that might be good for development?
I mean, basically the only kind of coding experience I had was either like tweaking my MySpace page back in the day, or like, you know, bare minimum, some like Dreamweaver graphic design from college. So I kind of went into it not even knowing what to expect. I mean, at that point, I wasn't even sure the difference between like front end dev and back end dev. Like I had no clue. So the classes were really kind of my first look at what it even was. And it was a little confusing at first, all the information, but I mean, it just kind of made sense to me. So I was like, yeah, I could do this.
So it did, like, in the beginning, it made more sense than maybe, like, because I did the same thing you did, and I got through, I think I typed in Hello World one time, like, this is not for me. Like, I just felt for this.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think it was just kind of, I like doing things kind of start to finish, and I like kind of completing things. So doing those classes and, like, building on everything, and, like, all of a sudden you're seeing this page that you built out of nothing. So I think kind of doing that just kept me going, because I was like, you know, by the end of it, I was like, here's a website, and I didn't know how to do this before I started.
I probably have like a million other questions, because you pretty much what I'm highlighting is that you did something I wanted to do and I did not do. So like, I'm like so interested in your kind of experience through there. But I guess moving on a little bit, you know, starting as a developer, many people like that don't end up becoming the president. A lot of them don't even move outside of development work, even, you know, getting to manager and stuff like that. But they tend to not go to marketing. They tend to not go to ops and obviously president sometimes. Not to say like no one does it. Sometimes it's just that's they kind of stay in their lane. Mm-hmm. So can you go through your growth through Meteora and how you became president?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know that I ever had any aspirations to be more. So, I mean, kind of again, it was me. I'd see kind of inefficiencies or problems or things, and I'd go to Andrew and be like, hey, this is annoying. You should do something about that. And leave it there. And then he was like, how about the next time you try to fix it? You know, you bring me the problem, the solution, all of it. And then it kind of changed the way I was thinking about things, kind of, I think, gave me a little ownership on the problems, because like complaining about something easy, fixing it is not. And so I started bringing solutions. We started talking more kind of about that kind of stuff. And it just kind of developed into like, you know, I think you have the skills to move into management. Like, is that something you want to do? And again, I was like, yeah, you know, I'll try it. Never been one, but you know, I think I can do it.
To double click on that a little bit more, like what else do you think, other than coming with problems, and then eventually realizing internally that you need to come up with a solution, not just problem, or, you know, Andrew kind of helped you say that as well. I totally forget what my question is. I've never done that.
Yeah, I think I know where you're going. It's like, how do you get to that point where it seems like you're always, even when you ask or come to Andrew with saying like, oh, this is a problem, right? It's stemming from a place of you're striving for whatever you're doing to be better. Like, where does that come from?
I think I've just kind of always been like that, you know, like I've always kind of wanted things to work well and thought about things in a way where I found the problems, the inefficiencies, and like, I guess I've just always wanted to kind of make things better. So, because I knew him before this job, I guess maybe I was more comfortable bringing these issues to him. Cause I don't know that if I just got hired and he was the CEO, I'd be like complaining to him about stuff. But, I think I just think long-term, I want to see like the whole picture. And I don't know that he'd ever had that before, where I was like thinking about problems that maybe hadn't even been problems yet that were going to be caused by what was happening. Kind of that kind of thinking made him start to be like, like, I think I could use you.
What were, where did that kind of thinking originate from? I guess like we asked this question of kind of like, what was going on during the formative years, like 5 to 12 years old, that potentially put you on this path to think the way that you do, which is different than most.
I mean, I think part of it is maybe I'm just built that way. Like, even as a little kid, I was always kind of like, hey, this is a problem. But I mean, I think part of it is, you know, I had a bit of a rough start in life. A lot of my issues had to be kind of self-solved. I didn't have kind of a lot of advice or opinions. So I think it was more just I trained myself to think all of that through independently. And so it gave me kind of a like a good groundwork for kind of being a manager and having to see like the whole view of everything.
You were tasked with problem solving from an early stage. I mean, that's, yeah, learning that in an early stage. I mean, most people don't really learn how to problem solve for a long time. So, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, now kind of combining both the calls together, because we're kind of getting into this conversation of you, you know, growing through the firm and everything. And I think that I forget the number, but there's like these seven types of CEOs. I don't know if you guys know what I'm talking about, but like, and I don't even remember the examples of the, each seven, but you know, some people are just better with processes, and other people are good at long-term vision and that kind of stuff. And usually you're great at one and you're not so good at the others, or maybe you're good at a few of the others, but not everything. So that's why a lot of times CEOs will kind of hire someone that takes care of the things that they're not good at. And that's what I really want to kind of focus on somewhat for this call, because again, there we have the president and the CEO. So one, you know, did you see something similar and did Andrew identify that? And that's kind of why he hired you as president. And then a similar-ish question is, you know, what are the similarities and differences between you and Andrew?
Yeah, I mean, I think that is why he kind of recognized it and why we work well together, because we are fairly similar, but he is always on to the next thing. It's big thoughts, big dreams, you know, plans, 3 years, 5 years, but it doesn't matter how to get there. He just wants to be there, you know? So I'm much more like, I want the process. I want the step. So he'll tell me, you know, whatever grand plan he's got. And I'm the one that kind of is like, okay, now let's figure out how to do it, how to do the steps, because he likes to start at like step 20. And I'm like, okay, let's walk it back a bit, you know, because that's not, that doesn't make any sense.
You're the one that builds the bridge.
Right. Like, I can get us there, but he doesn't, I mean, he doesn't want to be bogged down in the day to day, you know, because I mean, it is his job to be kind of the visionary, the person who's like, seeing trends and taking us to where we need to be. So he, like, we complement each other, because I want to be in the present. I want to be kind of like behind the scenes, pushing people along, making sure everything, the strategy is there, the vision. And I think part of that is he trusts that I can do that. And I trust that his ideas are what we need. So we work well together in the sense that he's like, I don't care how you do it, just like figure it out. And I'm like, okay, like I will. And that not to say we haven't had our fair share of disagreements, but I think the trust is built there at this point that we can disagree and get into it. And then the next day be like, I'm fine. I'm over it now.
Well, that was literally going to be kind of my next question, which is like, does that ever get frustrating, or is that kind of just how it should be? Because, you know, I think there's a lot of power when it comes, I call it like diversity in thought. So like, if everyone at a firm has this, is thinking the same exact way, you usually either cap yourself or you never even make it there. But when you get some diversity in thought, you get different opinions in the company, as long as everyone can work together efficiently. Mm-hmm. So the question in all of that is, you know, does it ever get frustrating?
I mean, yes. You know, I mean, when you're kind of disagreeing with somebody, it does get frustrating. But I mean, I think one of the things that I brought to him that kind of led me down this path that no one else did was that I did challenge him. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of people, I think, are afraid to, if they're the CEO or something, say like, hey, I don't know if that's a great idea, or maybe that's not the best way to do it. But I kind of immediately was like, you know, this isn't going to work. Here's why. Like, maybe rethink that. And I don't know that he ever had that with somebody else in the company before me.
which is grouped a lot of times in like the yes man type thing. Mm-hmm. Which, you know, I think a lot of CEOs and presidents and founders, they do, it's rare and few and far between, but they do typically appreciate that. And if they don't appreciate that, maybe that's a hit on them and not the rest of the firm. Then I need to know, like, when you both feel strongly about something, how does it get resolved?
I mean, the good part about our dynamic is that we do work well together. Like, we don't, I mean, have we like gotten mad and like maybe yelled at each other? Yeah, probably. But for the most part, I mean, it is just a very balanced conversation. It's like, here's my side, here's my side. And then, you know, obviously the real kind of path forward is always somewhere in the middle of that. And so we are able to communicate fairly effectively that by the end of the meeting, it's like, okay, here's what we're doing. We'll take some of yours, some of mine, and like, we've got the plan.
Yeah, so, you're hitting it from different aspects, right? So especially him with being visionary focused and you being process focused. There's, I think it's not necessarily that you may be conflicted on the vision or like where it needs to go, but you're bringing different sides of it. So there's obviously going to be friction there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I think when everyone's striving for the same goal, I wrote like, it's easier to get over things, but it's not even about getting over things. It's just like, you know, the other person cares. And when you know the other person, when that frustration, or let's call it like just passion, is coming out, sometimes that, you know, voices can rise and can get upset with the other person. But like, when you just get to take a step back and even sleep on it, you realize like, oh, that person, they're just doing that because they care. And like, mm-hmm. Both back in the same boat and you're both rowing the same direction. And I think that's kind of what you're saying as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Cause I mean, there's been a lot of times that I have like fully disagreed, but I think ultimately he knows that it's all because I care about the company. I care about the vision. And so ultimately he never gets too mad, cause he's like, she's probably coming from a good spot and from a process spot that I should probably listen to.
And you need to trust others sometimes more than yourself when they're in their lane, you know, like, I know that's usually where, whether it's micromanaging or just frustration starts to really like grow, is when someone starts to get in your lane and they try to make decisions based on that. And you're like, what am I here for then? You know? And mm-hmm. I think when two people can identify that, I think that's when you start to grow together and all that kind of stuff. So, then I have a question, because again, we talked about, you know, you being a developer and then director of ops and then president. I've asked this question in other kind of aspects, but like, what is the difference, the biggest difference between those three roles, if not like two? I really like separating the development work with like the director of ops / president. But if you want to split all three of them, you know, happy to take it in that direction.
Yeah, I mean, the biggest difference for me is as a dev, like I only had to worry about myself. You know what I mean? I could be in my office, I could check the boxes, do the things, call it a day. But, you know, now I have every decision, I have to worry about everyone below me, the whole company. Is it going to impact things, you know, 3 months from now? With dev work, I mean, there's a start, there's a finish, you know, it is what it is. But managing people, being kind of like administrative in a company is like completely different to me. And being the president, not too different from ops. I mean, it's more just I have more of an overview. You know, now there's more things to be nervous about, to worry about, to make sure are, you know, vibing together. So the switch from ops to here wasn't that jarring, but going into management, it was like, oh, okay, it's not about me and just checking off my tasks anymore.
And that's kind of what I wanted to learn about then. You know, like, what were the growing pains like, or, you know, how could you help someone, or what advice could you give to someone who might be going through the same thing? Again, you know, I keep highlighting this, but especially someone from like dev to management, which, you know, is different than marketing to management, or it's a lot different. So, yeah, like, what were the growing pains like, or what can you kind of help someone with who's going through the same thing?
I mean, it was rough, you know, I mean, not to stereotype developers, but, you know, they're not exactly known for people skills, personal, like, you know, kind of, so that was a jump, like having to learn kind of that communication, that everybody needs to be spoken to differently, that you have to kind of take the initiative to bring things up. Like, you know, I wasn't a manager ever before I moved into that role. And so I was learning every single thing as I did it, sometimes the hard way. But it's mainly just getting the confidence to bring things up, to talk to people, to be kind of more engaged with everybody than, you know, just like, ping me if you need me. I'm in my office, got my headphones on, like, don't bother me.
Which is in a zone I'd like to be in a lot as well. Is there anything you would have done differently, you know, now that you've kind of gone through the cycle a few times? And obviously there were growing pains. Like, yeah, is there anything you would have done differently?
Yeah, I mean, I think everybody kind of learns these lessons early on becoming managers, but, you know, it's just intimidating. Like, I moved from a lot of people, well, everyone here except for a couple people were my peers. So going from like a peer to, hey, I'm in charge of you now was weird. You know, it's uncomfortable to have to tell people that you're like friendly with, like, hey, you did wrong and now I'm correcting it. So I think just learning that is important, don't avoid it. You know, it's weird and it's uncomfortable, but the avoidance of that stuff makes things so much worse.
If you were promoting someone to, from a developer, or let's say like a doer into a manager, how would you position them in order to make that easier on them?
I mean, I think just like, you know, cause I'm kind of doing that with the person who replaced me. She was an account executive, not a dev, but I mean, it's mainly just asking the questions like, here's the scenario. How would you handle it? You know, this happened. What should you do? Because having that person to kind of just role play off scenarios makes it way easier than like you're in your own head. The situation is happening and you're like, oh my God, what do? I can't do poorly. I have to do something. Like, I don't want to look like an idiot. And then you're like on the fly trying to be the manager. So I think just kind of coaching, being there, getting the opinions, feedback, so that they can have that in the arsenal before they have to have that scenario happen.
When you were promoted to operations manager, was there like, what was the announcement like? Was there an announcement? And if there was, how did it happen?
I mean, before kind of I got into the role, things were, I mean, pretty casual. No real processes, no kind of real protocol for anything. So the announcement wasn't so much an announcement as it was like, I'm in the morning meeting, like, hey guys, like, I'm doing this now. Like, just, this is what it is, you know? So the transition was like a little, you know, rocky. But yeah, there was no kind of formal meeting announcement. It was just kind of, left on a Friday, came on a Monday, like slotted in, like, hey, I'm ops now. Hey guys.
I get that. I had a similar experience earlier on. I promoted one of our developers to development manager and notified them and other management. And then like 2 weeks later, one of our backend developers was like, is this person managing now? And I was like, oh shit, I fucked up.
Yeah, and I've made the same mistake too, kind of thinking this could be like a casual kind of thing, and then very much learning I should have made a bigger deal of it or done a meeting or an announcement. Because I do think I don't know now if it would have been helpful or not, but it would have made me maybe feel more confident, like knowing that everyone knew and everything was like in place before I was just like, we'll figure this out, guys. Don't worry.
Do you think that people are born managers to an extent? Like, you know, everyone can learn to an extent, but yeah, do you think that people are born managers?
I mean, I do think there are certain skills that you can't teach a person. You know, there's just certain, you just have to be a certain way, I think, to be successful. Because you could be a really good worker and you could be like the best on the team, but that doesn't mean you're going to be a good manager. Like, your kind of production work doesn't really have much to do with your managerial skills. You know, I think you have to be self-motivated. Like, you have to be a problem solver. And you have to just be a little tenacious. Like, I mean, stuff gets rough sometimes and you have to go home and be like, I'm going to do it one way or the other. I'm going to do it. And sometimes people just don't have those qualities. And I don't think you can make someone be that person.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I actually just got off a call earlier today where the whole company is trying to put this person as the manager. She's clearly has the skills and everything. But sometimes she's worried that she's too aggressive or something and stuff like that. And I'm like, honestly, I think everyone on that call needed to hear that. And when you just do a few reps like that, you do tend to learn, okay, this emotion was good in that situation, or maybe it wasn't good in that situation. Like, okay, next time I just will or won't do that, the same thing next time. And I think that's like everything, it's just reps. But curious if you kind of thought, you know, if people are born managers. Do you happen to know your Myers-Briggs?
Yeah, I'm an INTJ.
The question I'm going to ask is, are there like advantages to being an introverted president? But before even that, I love Myers-Briggs. Do you know what INTJ, like, do you know what the 16 personalities thing calls it or anything?
I can't remember now. Maybe it was an architect or something. I'm not
sure. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So like, can you explain kind of what that means to you?
I mean, for me, I think it is just more, I'm internal with most everything until I've kind of deemed it ready to be said out loud. Like, I will think it through a ton, very kind of introspective. Like, I don't present stuff kind of on the fly. Like that's another difference between Andrew and I. He just will go in a meeting and be like, I've got a thing to say. And I'm like, now that I've thought about this thing for weeks, I will now say it, you know. But I think it's an advantage because I can work it out like on my own enough that by the time I present it, like, some of the hiccups that maybe would have happened aren't there. But it's also a little bit of a disadvantage because I can get too in my head and kind of pump the brakes on things that probably are ready. I'm just trying to get it that like 3% more, and that doesn't even matter. So it's a little bit of a balance.
So that's, I love that answer. And that was a lot of internally. What about externally, you know, to the rest of the company? You know, what are there advantages, disadvantages of being an introverted president?
I mean, the one piece of feedback I get fairly consistently is that I'm always calm. Like, they're like, you never freak out. Like, you're always like, let's hear all sides. Let's find all angles. Like, so I think having kind of the introverted personality keeps me pretty level-headed. And I think that's important because, like, if I'm freaking out or if Andrew's freaking out, everyone's going to be scared. So I think kind of bringing that kind of calm energy, even if it's like a really big deal, keeps people from just like really losing it.
I think that's a great point. And now to move.
I forget what it was, but someone was looking at like, what is the, like, how much variation can you have from the middle to provide kind of like the happiest way for a company to progress forward, right? Like, you have highs where you're happy, you have lows when you're not, like, what's the best balance? And I think that it's interesting with how you describe the relationship you have with Andrew. He can be, you know, because he's innovative and forward thinking, he can go in any direction of those ways. And you're consistently bringing him back down to the middle, which is, I think, a great recipe for progress.
Yeah, I think that's, I always group that. I call it like Aristotle's mean, or Aristotle's, I forget. But it's this idea that everyone tends to bounce up and down, whether it's happiness, it can go into politics, it can go to anything. And people bounce because what they do is they identify that there's an issue. Maybe everyone's upset. So they try to go the other way, and they usually go too far, and then they identify mm-hmm. that too far, and then they come back. And the more someone can kind of close that gap or that parabola, that tends to be the better solution. So I think that was a really good point. And now going
that
to
is great, yeah.
And I'll go into some community questions. I'm really focusing on, you know, your employees, because I think that's, you know, a lot of times community number one when it comes to a business. What's the most important thing for you when it comes to building a community with your employees?
I mean, the most important thing for me is the company culture, you know, like the skills I can train, like, you know, we can manage a lot of kind of the skills-based kind of work stuff, but you have to, like, we all want to kind of vibe and align. And if you get somebody that's really not meshing with the team, I think that's a huge impact. So I think for me, I focus on like everybody kind of getting along and having things in common, because with that common ground, I think it makes you more of a team than if we were all just like completely different people.
Yeah, and there's another interview. Alex, maybe you remember the three words, but like she was saying how you identify these three people, and if you identify them, like you got to get them out of there. And it was like like the angry person, the one.
Yes, it was Sherry. Sherry, let me pull up her notes.
And I thought that was, well, while you do that, because I think my next question kind of also goes to that. But are you involved with hiring?
I am. Yeah, we work kind of me, Jen, who's an ops now, and Andrew as kind of a leadership team in terms of hiring. So, it is interesting because I, you know, in a bigger company, maybe wouldn't, but it is nice to kind of be involved from the beginning in that stuff.
Alex, I'm giving you a gap to see if you found those words before I jump into now. Okay. Then, you know, on the hiring front, what have you learned to look for and not look for? Because, you know, I think we've heard this a million times that people can knock it out of the park with an interview, and then that turns out not to be how they are. So, aka, you know, people are just good at interviewing. So, yeah, what have you looked for or maybe not looked for?
I mean, obviously, the skills is where we would start. But, I mean, that's the interesting part about kind of our field is it is very easy to lie and to have the vocabulary that, you know, because marketing is kind of not a super solid thing. You know, if you talk the talk, like it can seem very much like, you know, and I mean, we have been kind of in situations where we really thought this is the one, we did it. And then they get in and we're like, oh, we did not do it. So, I mean, I've learned a lot in the skills, but also I just think hiring is a little weird. Like, it's a bit of a gamble no matter what.
Yeah. Well, is there like, can there be a perfect science to that? Or like, don't strive for perfection there. It's just that's what happens in this process.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know that there's ever going to be a formula. I mean, with the dev kind of design stuff, I mean, obviously there's testing and like portfolios and proof, but with some of the other stuff, it's like, you just kind of have to take your own experience in the industry, trust your gut, and just, you know, hope that it's the right thing. And sometimes it's great and it's awesome. And sometimes you're like, yeah, I've made terrible mistakes.
Have you had do you implement any type of a ramp up process to full employment where they're kind of in this like phase of, let's see how this works for both of us?
Yeah, we kind of do the 90 day kind of, you know, get you onboarded, get you trained. You know, the expectations in terms of like work and things don't really start until kind of after that mark. The beginning stage is mainly like, you know, how are you doing? Are you getting the concepts? Like, do you like it here? Do we like you here?
Mm-hmm.
And so it's kind of us trying to suss out like the skills that maybe you can't interview about during that 90 days.
Yeah. And I did find the three people that Sherry mentioned before. This was from Sherry Lambert. She said there's three type of people you need to look out for in your organization and get rid of them as soon as possible. The manipulator, the person that's negative, and the drama queen.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I thought that was worth stating. Mm-hmm. And then my last question on the interview process, because I think you've heard a lot of great thoughts on this. I know people that are going through called like normal jobs, you know, I don't know how to say this nicely or not nicely, but like worker bee jobs, that they've gone through like 30 interviews and they still don't have a job. And it's not like, you know, they're not impressive. And then I know people who have sold companies and they've done 30 interviews and haven't got the job, you know? So from the bottom to the top, is there anything that you would recommend people change about their interview approach? Because sometimes people are so much in a vacuum, right? They're not watching other people's interviews and saying like, oh, I could borrow from that. They just have their own interviews and it's hard to know what they're doing right or wrong. But you have seen a lot of interviews. So again, yeah, the question, I guess, is like, what do you think people should change about their interview approach?
I mean, I think part of it is I know when I'm interviewing you, this is not your only interview. You know, we're not probably that special. But, you know, Googling the company, learning what we do, where even we're located, like having any sort of initiative to kind of learn past, hey, this is a job and I'm applying for it, is always nice. Because, you know, for us, we will kind of ask those questions and we get a lot of, oh, yeah, I looked at you do marketing. And, you know, I mean, I'm not asking the world. I'm just asking that you maybe went to our website for a couple minutes. So even that little bit of research to seem engaged with who you're being interviewed by, make it seem not just like, I just want a job, like I want this job with you all, would probably go a long way.
Yeah, it's the pro. Go ahead.
Can I kind of push against that a little bit? The one person, or at least one person I'm thinking of, they did more research than I've ever seen. And they still just interview after interview, you know, wasn't getting the luck. Eventually that person did just get a job actually within the last week or two. But anything else other than research that you could kind of recommend?
I mean, part of it is skills and not just, you know, like technical skills, like seeing kind of where you've worked, different places, having the ability to kind of answer problem solving questions. I think part of it is people get really nervous. Like also a lot of it's virtual interviews now, which is just kind of weird. It feels uncomfortable. Like you can't read people as well. So, I mean, partially getting used to just presenting yourself on a virtual environment, because you just aren't the same as you would be in person on a Zoom, or, you know, no offense, I know I'm on Zoom right now, but you know, it's hard to kind of, I guess, get your whole personality across virtually. So just really practicing kind of what skills you want to put forward and trying to make that happen is probably something to focus on.
I hear you. I'm a very animated person. So I'm like, damn it. Like half of Josh doesn't even come out on these damn things.
I don't know. I think it does. I think, yeah, your animation goes through the screen.
I hope so. I'm trying to over animate. I'm just kidding. But Alex, you had a question.
Yeah. There's, when we were talking with Andrew, he said that there was a point in time in the company where there was an acquisition that happened. And can you talk about that and what that did to culture? Or I guess, yeah, whatever insights you have on there. Because there's a couple of guests that we've had on the show recently that are going through an acquisition process that this will be helpful for.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of kind of the people that we brought over, we were fairly lucky in the sense that they kind of aligned from the jump for a lot of our characteristics. But that was different because, you know, when you're applying for a job, you're kind of willingly changing into the new job's culture, all this stuff. When we acquired them, it was like, well, you either come over here, do it how we do, or you can't have a job. So I think it's a little strange at first, like almost like a forced, like, yeah, I'm on board, I love it. But I think the biggest culture difference that we faced that we didn't maybe anticipate was from the clients. You know, because they're even more kind of just drug along for the ride. All of a sudden, we're here. It's new people. It's new procedures. It's new way of doing things. And I think for the clients, that was like fairly jarring. Like it was very like, okay, but I liked it the other way. And when they work in the company, it's a little bit easier to like get the buy-in and like prove the like why. But as a client, I don't know that we interfaced with them. Like it's not like it's every day. So it was a little bit harder kind of bringing them along and getting their buy-in on the culture than it was the actual employees that we brought over.
Interesting point. Yeah. There's a lot of times in the acquisition, I mean, part of the deal is how much revenue is coming along mm-hmm. with this acquisition. And people, I guess, don't really spend too much time thinking about, is there the right culture fit for the clients that we're essentially acquiring. So, mm-hmm. Yeah, you raise a really good point there. I didn't think about it.
Are you open to, and I honestly think this is like the biggest question that no one can really answer prior to the acquisition, but are you open to sharing like what percentage of clients stayed with you guys?
I don't know the exact percentage. I mean, we did lose some. I don't know that it was necessarily due to work or anything. You know, it's just we had some time zones and things that, right. You know, we kind of learned didn't work. So, I mean, we have a few left, but for the most part, because we're a year and a half, 2 years out from the acquisition. So it was a lot of kind of maybe our pricing's changed and they're like, oh, well, whatever, like come resign. So we do have a few, but we learned quite a bit during this because this was our first time kind of acquiring a company.
What would be the biggest? Oh, go ahead, Josh.
Well, I guess I was just wondering, were you really looking for more revenue or talent? Like, what was the biggest goal of that acquisition?
I mean, I think for us, it was maybe a little both, but the talent was interesting to us, you know, kind of that was an interesting way to like bring on multiple people at once with the skill set that we needed, kind of already working and living in kind of the marketing world. But I think part of it was kind of expanding our client book, becoming a larger entity. And for us, that was kind of an easy way to do that, like at once, you know? So.
What would be the biggest point of advice that you would that you would give to someone who is acquiring a company for those same reasons?
I would just say really, really do the research, you know, look into the client, you know, likes, dislikes, where they're located, what services they need. Look into the employees coming over. Like, do they want to be full-time employees? Do they want to be, you know, maybe contractors? There's just way more to consider in an acquisition than you probably ever would have to in like a normal hire. So it's just a lot of data, look at the data, do the research, spend more time upfront before the deal than you probably think you should, just to really know that you've seen kind of everything that needs to be seen.
And then one question there, the acquisition happens, right? You've like all of the paperwork and funds are exchanged or scheduled at least. What's the first thing that you do?
I mean, the first thing we did was prior to the acquisition, we interviewed everybody, you know, because we did want to make sure, you know, do you want to come over here? Is it something you're interested in? But I mean, almost immediately, it was just bringing everyone in, clients, employees, and really trying to build the relationships, get everything we needed, and really get started because we just didn't want any sort of disruption in their jobs, their service lines, anything like that, because we already knew, hey, this is like, you know, an acquisition's a little strange. So it was a huge focus on just onboarding internally and externally just to make sure everything was good to go from the jump.
Yeah. And I just want to say that I really appreciate you sharing a lot of that because like Alex mentioned, we've had a few of those conversations. And again, with this goal of this podcast of building this community between the guests that we have, whether it's referrals or just like, you know, how people are thinking or going through things.
Advice, things like that. Yeah.
Advice, thank you. Yeah. I think it's really important. And you know, hopefully if you're open to it, you know, maybe some of these people that are a few stages back and thinking about acquisition can kind of reach out or, you know, we'll help connect you guys. Mm-hmm. And say like, you know, these two people have gone through, or these two companies have gone through it. Maybe we can have a short conversation about, you know, the things they learned and things they would change and all that kind of stuff. So much, much appreciated on all that. A few questions I tend to ask at the end that we'll run through. If you had to teach something to other marketers, what would it be?
I think, you know, it's important for marketing in particular, just to one, be able to market yourself. You know, I mean, I think a big part of why clients come to us instead of the, you know, million other digital agencies is because we are Meteora and not, you know, So I think being able to speak to why you as a company are the best rather than like, here's what we do is probably the most important part. Cause I mean, like I said, I mean, marketing is all the talk at the beginning. So it's kind of proving why we are the best people, not that, you know, we do marketing.
I think that was one of my favorite answers to that question that we've gotten. I don't think anyone's shared that. And I think it's so like obvious while not being obvious at all. That was a fantastic answer. How can you work with other marketing agencies, or, you know, what other services can you partner with other agencies? So in other words, what do other agencies tend to reach out to you for?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of times we've kind of scaled everything back, but previously, you know, 3-4 years ago, we did everything, probably too much. And so a lot of companies would come to us because, you know, we had service lines that they didn't, in terms of like the custom development, things like that. Videography, photography, things like that is one that a lot of times people will kind of not have in-house and want to kind of outsource. So I think a lot of it is more the niche stuff that like maybe the clients don't want all the time, but it is important. So it's probably easier just to like coordinate with other agencies than have like a team that does that for the occasions that you need it.
And what are those niches?
Well, I mean, like I said, videography, it's getting bigger, but you know, not every single client, especially in our market, needs that. So it's easier to kind of have a trusted partner. Or like I said, a lot of people would come to us for that custom development piece for the app that goes with the website or the portal that needs built, because those kind of large scale projects don't happen enough that you could probably justify all the time having a person with the experience level, the pay requirements, things like that permanently on your team. So it's just nice to kind of know somebody who does it. So I think all of the agencies kind of have a list of like, oh, well, we don't do that, but they do, or this, I can refer you to this person, so that it's just kind of a total picture throughout any of the referral sources.
Yeah, and this is probably my most brought up example that I talk about on multiple episodes, but it's because I think it's so important. But you know, I always use the diner example. When you go to a restaurant that has, you know, everything under the sun on the menu, it usually means nothing is that great there. As opposed to when you go to those fine dining restaurants and there's like three things on the menu, you know that their services, or in this case the food, is probably a lot better per service or dish. So I think that's and to your point, you know, we've talked to a few marketing agencies that their aim was to be that full service, and then they realized they're kind of diluting all the services and not providing the best service for their clients. So, you know, I think that's worth mentioning. So now I'll take that last question and I'll kind of flip it. So if a client asks, you know, can you do this? And you might have actually answered a little bit of this, but can you do this in a service you don't currently provide? How do you currently handle that request?
I mean, depending on what it is, I mean, if it's something we've previously done, we may have some resources just like we could ask on like a one-off basis. But, you know, we have some referral partners in other kind of lanes in marketing that a lot of times what'll happen is it's like, hey, this project's probably not something we do anymore. Maybe like too small, too big, any of that, but let me give you an intro to these people because they focus on it. They'd be great at it, stuff like that. Because we'd rather have that partnership where they're going to do 100% than us try to do it and just maybe not hit the mark.
And word of mouth is powerful, good and bad. So anytime
exactly
you get something in that good column, it does help the growth and everything else of the company. So I think that's important. Just a few more questions. If you were to listen to this show, what topics would you like us to cover?
I mean, I think some of the stuff we've talked about, like the acquisition thing, I think is interesting and important. I think a lot of people in our industry think about doing that at some point or another. So it would be helpful to maybe get kind of, you know, behind the scenes look. And I think, you know, culture is always interesting to me. Like, what are companies doing different internally than other places to have maybe like better retention or better satisfaction with the staff, you know, things like that, more kind of internal agency things.
Awesome. And are you guys looking to hire any positions right now?
Yeah, we are actually. We are looking for a graphic designer, which could be web-based, could be ad-based. We've got a couple. Now that you've said that, I've like forgotten all of the other ones. But yes, we are.
And then my last question, and maybe my favorite question, any books, podcasts, or newsletter recommendations?
In terms of kind of business stuff, I mean, we did the EOS track, and I know Andrew briefly touched on it, and that kind of opened up a lot of business books that I think are pretty good. Like, you know, just the EOS stuff in general is good, but, you know, Dysfunctions of a Team, thing, books like that. I'm always going to read like management books, so maybe not interesting to marketing people, but I think anybody can read that stuff and probably learn something in terms of interpersonal skills. So any sort of kind of team-based managerial type books is what I'm into right now.
Any other specifics?
You know, you're asking me this and it's like my brain has never heard of a book before. So I'm like drawing a complete blank on anything I've ever read, if I'm being honest.
The camera pressure is, I feel you. That's the first time I forgot a question today. So maybe it's just something in the air or something. So, and as we come up to the end of the episode, I just want to give you an opportunity to mention how people can find you and anything else you'd like to end with.
Yeah, you can find us at Meteora.com, on LinkedIn, social media. You can email us. My email is Amelia@Meteora.com. But yeah, any kind of social media channels and our website is probably the best way.
Awesome. And thank you so much for coming on the show. And for those of you who have learned something new from this episode, please consider giving us a like or a follow so we can continue getting the highest quality of guests. And as always, thank you for listening, Amelia. Oh, this is awesome. This is such a great, it was obviously, like I mentioned, our first time doing two people in the same company. And I feel like we just got through like everything that I kind of wanted to, and
that's great.
Persons and everything. So thank you so much for coming.
We should do more of it. Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you.
It's so much more dynamic. Yeah.
Awesome. Thank you so much. Thanks for listening to the Masters in Marketing Agency podcast. I hope you got a ton of value out of this episode. And before we go, I just want to thank our sponsors, DevNoodle. DevNoodle provides marketing agencies with the ability to offer their clients unlimited website design, build, and management services with fixed monthly plans. If website design, development, and maintenance is holding your agency back from growing, please reach out to us at devnoodle.com, where we make websites easy for you and easy for your clients. devnoodle.com.